Graham Harper's sound and director's vision, quite literally providing a whole new audio perspective on the craft of the moving image. And if you don't understand what that means, let me just tell you, Graham Harper's awesome.
Dum 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 dum. Oh, I must sorry, Graham. It's your show, but clearly Puffin Billy, which has launched your latest segue into clearly the '50s with a vengeance for this particular theme and this particular episode. It's like nostalgia has never gone away, really.
Oh, absolutely. The reason I wanted to play that and then the subsequent pieces we're going to listen to is because when I became a director in the 80s, a producer I worked with discussed with me when we were talking about music. I was going to get music I could put into something. And she said, what you need at the beginning of your program is a wonderful clarion call that will make everybody go, oh, I must go and watch this. And it stuck with me, that lovely expression, a clarion call. So the clarion call is the theme tune, the opening theme tune to anything, that's whether it's radio or television or movies or theatre. And so I was very aware from the age of 4 and 5, where I avidly listened to the radio. We didn't have television when I, in the late 40s, early 50s. That came a little bit later. So I was listening to the radio. And the very first program I really remember as a child, 4 or 5 years old, was that piece of music introducing children's favourites with Uncle Mac. And as soon as that music came on, I think, certainly I did, that was the clarion call. That's what she meant. And I, oh, it's Uncle Mac. And I rushed downstairs from my bedroom, if I was there, or whatever I was doing, to go to the radio and sit in our living room and listen to Uncle Mac playing children's favourites, people you would write in. And it was really hilarious, really, when you think of it. It would be outrageous now. But in those days, Uncle Mac said, and here is a, this is a request from so-and-so and so-and-so, who lives at number 47, Bloomsrock Road, Corfmullen, and would give the full address of the person who had written in. And then they were, he would then, you know, having given five or six, read out five or six addresses who'd requested this particular piece of music, he would then play the music. And see, one of the sorry, a big pun.
I was just going to say, my kind of take on that is probably the voice of Ed Stewpot Stewart, and then latterly Tony Blackburn with Junior Choice on BBC Radio 1 on weekends. Presumably that was the natural successor to Uncle Mac.
Absolutely. And Uncle Mac was slightly stilted and terribly British, and had this quaint Noel Coward way of speaking. But and also, the other thing that was interesting was, at the beginning, you had, I think before the music started, you always had Uncle Mac saying, "Hello, children, everywhere." And he had this kind of strange, I don't know what recording, they must have used recording number 74 of him saying, "Hello, children, everywhere," because the "everywhere" was odd. It didn't have, it had a really strange lilt to it. And I was fascinated as a five-year-old why this bloke said "everywhere." It was odd. So if anybody ever has a chance to listen to an original recording of Uncle Mac saying that, you'll see exactly what I mean. But it didn't stop me from wanting to listen. And there were always, I used to hope every week he'd seem to play the same tune that I was desperate to hear, which was The Runaway Train, which I really love. Another favourite was Reginald Gardner doing a monologue about called Trains. And that was so, it was like George Sanders doing imitations of railway. It's really funny. And again, in this very stilted British accent. But we all loved it. We all hung on to everything he said.
Well, we launched, obviously, with Puffing Billy, which, of course, is also the world's oldest surviving steam locomotive, originally constructed in 1813 to 1814. So just before you were born then, Graham, basically, in terms of that particular aspect. But clearly we're about to hear parts one and part two of the aforementioned Reginald, not Perrin, not Magdalen, but somebody completely different, doing his take on Trains, as featured in The Youth of Graham Harper.
I have a theory about railway engines being bad-tempered. Well, when I say bad-tempered, that's putting it mildly. They're actually livid, furious beasts, and they loathe humanity. So different from a ship, which is a sad, proud, graceful creature. You know, I can never understand why an engine driver isn't afraid of the monster he's in charge of. But he isn't. And when the train's about to leave, he pulls down a lever, and this livid beast is unleashed. Like this. So forth on its journey. Well, now we've unleashed this livid beast, we find it still equally furious, and it has a colossal argument with the rails it's running on, like this: biddle-a-dirt, giddle-a-dirt, diddle-a-dee, biddle-a-dirt, giddle-a-dirt, diddle-a-dirt, biddle-a-dirt, giddle-a-dirt, and that goes on the entire journey. And not only does it have a colossal argument with the rails it's running on, but also all the other rails when they dare to cross its own. Like this: biddle-a-dirt, giddle-a-dirt, diddle-a-dee, biddle-a-dee, 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 diddle-a-dee, and so on. Well, then we get out into the country, and we come to a little rustic bridge spanning the railway. It's quite inoffensive, this dear little bridge, but the engine can't bear anything within its reach at all, so it shouts at the little bridge as it goes underneath. Like this: biddle-a-dirt, giddle-a-dirt, diddle-a-dirt, biddle-a-dee, biddle-a-dee, giddle-a-dee, biddle-a-dee. Incidentally, talking about this argument with the rails, this biddle-a-dirt business, I'm not a much-travelled man, but I'm told this goes on all over the world in all the different railways. For instance, in France, exactly the same thing takes place, and the language is different, you know. Suck it yourself. It's all much the same thing. And speaking of France, the first time I ever went there, I arrived at Calais, and very close to the quayside, I came across my first glimpse of a French engine. I was vastly impressed, because it seemed to me to be four times as big and eight times as livid as any engine I'd ever seen before. To begin with, it had eight of everything, cow catchers and bells and everything but the kitchen stove hanging all over it, added to which it had a very bad-tempered word written across the front. It just said, "No," which I know is horrid to start with. And it was a great pleasure to find that I was allowed to do something in France that I'm not allowed to do in my own country, namely that I could walk across the line to get to the platform on the other side instead of going over by that maddening bridge. So I picked up my little bag and walked in front of this monster, cowering away from it, and suddenly, to my amazement, it let out an extraordinarily effeminate voice. It seemed to me to be so enormously masculine, and yet as it started on its journey for Paris, all it managed to summon up was, "Fuh!" Of course, I may be wrong about that, but it really does seem to me to be a little peculiar. And now, if you'll be so good as to turn the record over, we'll go on with our journey. Proceeding on our journey, we find from time to time that we tear through certain wayside stations where no train has ever deigned to stop. People have been standing waiting on these stations for centuries, but the engine ignores them, shouting as it rushes past like this. Then, of course, in time, we get to a manufacturing town. Now, when you get to these big towns, if you look out of the window, you'll notice some things called sidings, on which a quite inexplicable thing called shunting takes place. This, of course, is just an excuse on the part of the railway company to provide homes for old engines. You see, there comes a time with an engine when it ceases to be virile and hearty, and it just becomes long-funneled and tiresome, so it's put on one of these sidings and given a lot of trucks to play with. And if you happen to have a bedroom anywhere near a siding, you'll find that you're woken up very early in the morning by trucks taking umbrage. And it goes like this. To the far end. Then, of course, there's another old gentleman the other end who decides to do the same thing and biffs them all back again. And in this way, the railway company is carried on. Now, there's one thing I must know before I die, and that's something that takes place in a tunnel outside Snow Hill Station, Birmingham. You dash into the tunnel very fast, and the brakes go on, and you look out of the window, and all down the tunnel at intervals are a lot of flare lights. And in between these flare lights are men, standing. They're leaning on shovels and pickaxes and golf clubs or anything they can get hold of. And these men, they live there, definitely. And as you go slowly through the tunnel, an extraordinary noise starts at the far end and slowly crashes past the window. I've no idea what it is, but it goes something like this. Blong, 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 blong. Dalong, 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 dalong. I think it's a piece of tin, which has been nailed to the side of the tunnel with some number on it or something which doesn't seem to mean anything to anybody, and it's too big. And it strikes the side of the train as it goes through. And presumably the men are merely there to bend the tin back, ready for the next train to hit it when it goes through the tunnel. Now, lastly, I'm going to tell you the one thing that an engine loathes more than anything else, and that is another engine coming in the opposite direction. That it cannot bear. And by this time, you'll have settled down, having got quite used to this diddle-dum, diddle-dum nonsense and all the other maddening noises, when suddenly, to your horror, this new thing bursts upon you and nearly knocks you on the carriage floor. It's the most frightening thing in the world, and it goes something like this. Biddle-da, giddle-da, biddle-da, 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 hall-da, 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 da, bull-da, diddle-da, bull-da. Well, folks, that's all. Back to the asylum. Goodbye.
Well, extraordinary. Over 6 minutes worth of magic. Parts one and parts two, as we mentioned. And how we actually get from that to Operation Luna, only you can tell us with respect to Journey into Space, 38 seconds, which, of course, really kind of gets as up-to-date, arguably, as the BBC got in terms of its space opera series, with, of course, I think David Jason, I believe, was in a couple of them, or not David Jason, another famous David. David Jacobs, who was actually in this weekly serial adventure. So is this where you got your early exposure to science fiction, or was that Quatermass? Or was it Quatermass on television? And, of course, Journey into Space on the radio.
You know, Journey into Space came first. It was in 1953. When I heard, I think my mother was always the turner on of the radio, and she knew I loved certain programs as a little kid. So she'd make sure, and she also watched and monitored what I was listening to, obviously. So she heard about this program coming on, and she knew that I'd be interested in this science fiction story. So she made sure that I was told that there was a program coming on called Journey into Space. So 1953, I was now 8 years old, and the music and the voiceover that introduced Journey into Space, when that came on, I mean, in 1953, that was very modern, strange music, with this creepy voiceover saying Journey into Space. It was really strange. I found it very creepy and scary. And there was a character in it called Lemmy, who was a Lemmy Barnett, I think he was there. But he was the engineer of the crew. Alfie Bass. And I associated myself with him, although I was only 8 years old, and he was clearly 30 or 40 years old, this and a Cockney. But he was every man. He was Mr. Everyone. And he wasn't heroic. He was very frightened and nervous, but also pleased, I suppose, to be with the crew and be a member of the crew. But I saw the whole thing through him and his fear and terror of what they were doing on the moon was the first story. It was a very, very good serial, and I loved it. And I think anybody that heard that music in those days rushed to the radio to be frightened out of their lives. It was wonderful.
Well, let's have a listen to Journey into Space and Operation Luna.
Journey into Space. BBC presents Jet Morgan in Operation Luna.
From a historical fact, of course, Graham, that was actually the last radio program in the United Kingdom to attract a bigger evening audience than television. Kid on the Block, Journey into Space. And of course, you were one of those listeners who would actually gather around your particular Bakelite radio set, or was it
it's Bakelite.
There we are, listening to Journey into Space. Got to ask the question, because it comes at a time 2 years, because 1953, obviously Queen's coronation as well, but 2 years after, of course, the Eagle had landed, quite literally as a comic magazine, as an attempt by, indeed, a vicar to actually start matching the American excitements of Superman and its adventure comics and so on. But with respect to, obviously, Eagle, Dan Dare was very much one of the staple characters of Dan Dare. I have this image of you actually sort of with the Eagle comic and maybe the Wizard, maybe the Hotspur, etc. Was that very much kind of instrumental in terms of, you know, the ultimate Graham Harper, young Graham Harper version of Paradise, Hotspur, Dander, Eagle comic, and of course the BBC radio programme Journey into Space?
Oh, absolutely. Dan Dare, he was on the front cover, if I remember, of the Eagle. Oh, that was every Friday or Thursday or Friday when that comic came out. And that was like getting the Times. That was the Times version of a comic. That was the tops. That was class. If you could afford to have the Eagle, you were really somebody. My parents made sure I had that. Not they had any money, but it's very interesting. Yes, Dan's Dare also used to be on, if I'm right, wasn't it on Radio Luxembourg?
think he emerged in various forms. So he still keeps going these days, of course, in various incarnations. So he's never quite gone to get away together, of course, with his faithful companion, Digby. In fact, when I first encountered Journey into Space, I did feel as though they were ripping off Dander, because Digby also was a somewhat working class soul who kind of got into lots of trouble with him.
Yes, he was Mr. Everyman. He was not very heroic, but he got himself into all sorts of trouble, and Dander got him out of it, I suppose. Yeah, very good. In between that, there was another thing that really hit me, was that there were two things I used to do under the bedclothes as a little boy.
We have to be careful now.
But I'm going to steer us onto radio, or keep it radio. And that was, I used to listen to the American Forces Network programs coming out of air bases in Berlin, or in Germany anyway, because I discovered rock and roll, the good old Elvis Presley and those rockers of that period, who hadn't quite got to England yet. They were coming, but you could hear them on the American Forces networks, and jazz, which I, as a very young kid, I got interested in jazz, would you believe? And the other was Radio Luxembourg, which I used to listen to on a little crystal radio under the bed sheets late at night, where you'd hear, late at night for a little kid.
Were you an authentic Ovaltiner, Graham?
Did you? I was.
The Ovaltinis.
We are the Ovaltinis. I'd forgotten all about that. And I used to love hearing, as soon as I heard their jingle, Radio Luxembourg, Station of the Stars, on 208 medium wave. Ah, terrific. That was a must. I listened to that every night.
But they had commercials, Graham. I mean, there's a BBC following. I mean, if you're listening to that, to the Light programme and the Home Service, I mean, it must be a shock to actually have commercial radio broadcasting.
It was annoying. But I must admit, I did like some of the adverts, like We Are the Ovaltinis. That was fun. So Radio Luxembourg and their jingles were the forerunners of pirate radio, really. And they fed, I suppose, the idea of pirate radios, which became a few years later really, really big. And it had huge competition.
Are you suggesting, Graham, that actually the 2 hours per week on a Saturday morning, which the BBC deemed appropriate to actually dedicate to this popular music malarkey, that was not actually sufficient out of the 168 hours that was actually provided?
It was not. And guess what? They changed, didn't they? Certainly did. It was.
We can certainly sort of go into the advent of how Anthony Wedgwood Benn was responsible for closing down the loophole which enabled the 3 or 4 years of pirate radio to exist between 1964 and Radio Caroline and Radio London up to 1967, with, of course, the onset of Tony Blackburn, back again, of course, with Flowers in the Rain, launching the BBC Radio 1 programme, when, of course, the Home Service split into Radios 1 and 2, and the Light programme split into Radios 3 and 4 from the historical perspective. But let's move back a little bit further to the 7th of October 1946, because this is when, of course, serials, as opposed to series or series of serials, are very much at the heart of radio broadcasting. In particular, a certain character called Dick Barton, who effectively launched here 15-minute episodes, aired at 6:45 each weekday evening from the 11th of January 1947. And you were quite a fan of Dick Barton, and presumably his faithful sidekick, Snowy.
Snowy and Ginger. Absolutely. That was a must. That was glorious 15 minutes. Again, I must have listened to that when I was 4 or 5 years old for a couple of years. And the music, The Devil's Gallop, when you heard that clarion call, you ran. You did the 4-minute mile to get to the radio to listen to this really, really corny but exciting thriller serial. Dick Barton was, a captain in the SAS. Or Marine Commando, sorry, I think he was a commando, and his faithful kind of allies, which were Snowy and Ginger, and they were, I suppose, they must have been sergeants and sergeant majors or whatever in the army. But anyway, they solved political and major. They saved the world every week, so it was pretty good going. They were very, very exciting, and that music was, it's creepy. It's quite, and very, very much of its period. It was wonderful, wonderful to listen to.
It is the Devil's Gallop, of course, and I think we're about to hear it right now. Produced and directed by Raymond Raikes, Neil Tewson, and Charles Lafoe. 711 episodes in all, yes, produced of Dick Barton. You had, of course, was it a case of you caught it on the 15-minute episodes either at 6:45 or 6:15, or did you wait for the Sunday morning omnibus between 11 and 12 noon?
Do you know what? I listened to it all. I would listen to every programme and then go to the omnibus to hear, which was kind of shorter. Well, it wasn't. It was an amalgamation of four or five episodes, but it was tighter. So it was really, really fast. Very exciting. Do you know, sorry, just what was interesting, that the BBC decided that that was not suitable material, really, for the audience. So they would replace it with The Archers.
Yeah. There's a whole new world in terms of The Archers. But interesting enough, peak audience, 15 million were listening to Dick Barton. At its height, again, between 1947 and 1951, the 30th of March 1951, when it sort of went there. And again, not quite getting the legacy of Dan Dare, but every so often there's discussions, a bit like Sexton Blake, I suppose, of other characters that kind of emerged that people have got a vague recollection of. You think will be there. I think there was a short-lived ITV television series in the 80s.
Yeah, I think there was.
In Capture Dick Barton. Were you ever tempted to actually do a version, an updated version of Dick Barton, or was it a case of, no, let it lie?
I think it was let it lie. It was very much of its period and quite hammy. I'm sorry, chaps, but it was good ham. And look, you've got 15 million people listening, and I'm sure it sold all over the world. Well, maybe it didn't. I don't know. I hope so.
Precisely. Dick Barton, special agent, of course, the full scenario. Interesting enough, Dick Barton was born in High Wycombe on the 10th of December 1912. He's 5 feet 11 inches in height and weighs 11 stone 6 pounds. Complexion is fair, and he has chestnut hair. In a varied career, so this is quite important, he helped construct a Peruvian airport and an oil pipe in Persia. He also traveled the world. So it kind of it sort of demonstrates that whole side of things in terms of, you know, clearly the areas that are worked from that point of view, and actually working from Persia to Peru were quite understandably sort of leads to why Dick Barton, special agent, was a critical side of things. Particularly interesting in terms of the notion of Dick Barton wanted for murder. So he's still there, and of course we can listen again to so much Dick Barton stuff, because thankfully the BBC didn't actually wipe all the shows, and they still actually are in existence. You can track them down.
Yeah, he was a period Indiana Jones.
Yeah. 1978, it actually was a time when Southern Television, do you remember that television company? Southern Television.
I do, yes.
Actually produced a series starring Tony Vogel as Dick, Anthony Heaton as Snowy, and James Cosmo as Jock. Script written by Julian Bond and Clive Exton. That was the short-lived sort of Dick Barton television series that worked through there. And still working through that. On to Coronation Scott. So what is it about the Coronation Scott in particular that, again, opens up another very period evocative theme memory?
What's lovely about that is diddly-dee, 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 diddly-dee. It's wonderful. It's again a great clarion call. I wish they call it that, not the opening theme tune, the clarion call. It's wonderful. Again, when you heard that, it was it's probably my memory now. It's just lovely atmospheric music. that conjured up this very classy detective called Paul Temple, I've got to remember the writer's name. Now it's gone right out of my brain. Very, very famous writer. It'll come to me in a second. But these were Francis Durbridge. And he was a very, very famous thriller writer. He wrote, obviously, Paul Temple and many, many other characters for both radio and television, and also published. Paul Temple was just a very classy class act of a detective with his wife, who I think was a journalist in the series. And they, again, did the same as Dick Barton and all the other detectives. They saved the world from itself and from political scandals to great murders and horrific murders, etc., huge robberies. They were the go-to detective to sort out the world's problems. And it was really fast, very atmospheric, and started to become performed very naturally. So you suddenly had a different style of acting now on the radio, whereas before it was slightly stilted and anybody care for a sausage, darling, to a very, very modern style of acting, which I thought was terrific. And I suppose at the age of 12 or 13, I probably did start to notice that because I was an actor or a young actor, so I kind of got really hooked on it because the performances were so good.
Indeed, Paul Temple, occupation private investigator, with his wife Louise, affectionately known as Steve, in reference to her journalistic pen name of Steve Trent. So obviously sort of one for the gender fluidity, yes, from that point of view. He solves whodunit crimes through subtle, humorously articulated deduction. Of course, Francis Matthews, the voice of Captain Scarlet, would go on to play Paul Temple in the TV series of the same name that launched, I think, sometime in the 1970s. And I suppose something which even Quentin Tarantino might have found quite shocking, the strongest expletive that Paul Temple would ever employ in his character is, "By Timothy."
Isn't it wonderful? It's brilliant. No, very safe. Very, very safe programmes. You didn't hear very much swearing. Not even the goons. I don't think the goons ever did anything really, really rude, apart from lots of farting.
By Timothy. From there, of course, we move to the conclusion of this little segue through all manner of things, from railway engines through to Puffin Billies, through to Journey into Space, and indeed private detectives and saving the world, to a person who doesn't exactly save the world, but certainly saves the lawless United States from falling into even more vicious scenarios. Of course, we're talking about that epic scenario with the William Tell Overture. So a mixture of all sorts of things here, the William Tell Overture, and of course the epic scenario of that. Who was that masked man with a click of his heels and a hi-ho silver away, accompanied by his faithful companion Tonto? So is this a case of, well, fundamentally, American glamour once again wins out with respect to the Western and that masked hero, the Lone Ranger?
The Lone Ranger. Look, there have been wonderful, fabulous, big American Westerns in movies. Stunning. They have the art. That's where it all is for the Western. And loads of big movies, which obviously cost a lot of money, have been on the screen, and we've really enjoyed them. But this, which I think was made very cheaply, this whole series, as a child, I had to watch this. I love Westerns. I always have done, and I always will do. I found this really captivating. I found his innocence and honourability, and that Tonto was so loyal, having helped him when he was very badly wounded, how they first met. He nurtured him through a very dreadful period to saving his life, basically. And so they were absolutely blood brothers. They were really as one. And Tonto was a huge hero to me. I used to love watching this program. And I guess as a young kid, I learnt about morals and the fact, I mean, I do swear a lot, so it didn't rub off for a long time. However, as a young boy, I didn't. I wanted to be like the Lone Ranger, and I wanted to do good and try and do my best. It was like being in the Boy Scouts, really, because this character was very, very honourable, and he spoke very pontifically, didn't he? He was, you know, it was almost patronising as in the way he played. But he was a must. You had to see it. You had to watch this programme. It was very exciting.
Although, of course, he does have his origins in radio. He first appeared in 1933 on a radio show for WXYZ in Detroit, conceived either by station owner George Trendle or indeed by Franz Stryker, the show's writer. The radio series proved to be such a hit, it spawned a series of books and then an equally popular television show that ran from 1949 to 1957, with Clayton Moore presumably being the Lone Ranger you recognise as the main person for that. Comic books, movies, of course. The title character on the radio show is played by Earl Grazer for some 1,300 episodes, which obviously shows the longevity of the character, and something which, again, many people were taken by surprise when, of course, the incarnation with, I believe, Johnny Depp as Tonto in recent years didn't quite manage to capture the same thing. You could argue that perhaps part of the approach that Clayton Moore could take or took on the Lone Ranger also influenced Adam West when he did the Batman in 1966.
Yes. They were the same, weren't they? Obviously, Batman was Batman, and Clayton Moore was the Lone Ranger. But they were interchangeable. They were exactly the same sort of character. And Jay Silverheels, what a lovely name for an actor. Jay Silverheels playing Tonto. It's brilliant. What a lovely name.
And let's just test your Lone Ranger knowledge here, Graham. What is the real name of the Lone Ranger? What's his alter ego when he was just the Ranger before he actually, his Ranger team was basically sort of decimated by villains and he was rescued by Tonto? What was his real name?
Paul Temple?
John Reed.
Ranger John God. Reed.
expert marksman, above average athlete, horseman, hand-to-hand combatant, and indeed master of disguise. So you've almost got a Western version of Sherlock Holmes there as well, which would add to the mask as well. The backdrop, as you said, the Lone Ranger, hence the title, the Lone Sole Survivor of a group of six ambushed Texas Rangers. The basic story, of course, is that a posse of six members of the Texas Ranger Division, led by Captain Dan Reed, pursued a band of outlaws led by Bartholomew Butch Cavendish, but were betrayed by a civilian guide named Collins, who was secretly working with Cavendish, and they led the unsuspecting Rangers into an ambush at the canyon known as Bryant's Gap. And from there, a Native American named Tonto stumbled onto the grisly scene, discovered one of the Rangers, Captain Reed's younger brother John, hence John Reed, barely alive, nursed the man to health, and the world was never again the same, really. Or the Western world, shall we say.
So we needed them.
Indeed, we'll wrap up the sequence today with the moral code that was put in place by the creator of the Lone Ranger, the aforementioned Stryker, who is there, Franz Stryker, the writer, and he was basically arguing that, I believe that to have a friend, a man must be one, that all men are created equal and that everyone has within himself the power to make this a better world, that God put the firewood there, but that every man must gather and light it himself in being prepared physically, mentally and morally to fight when necessary for what is right, that a man should make the most of what equipment he has, that this government of the people, by the people and for the people shall live always, that men should live by the rule of what is best for the greatest number, that sooner or later, somewhere, somehow, we must settle with the world and make payment for what we have taken, that all things change but truth, and that truth alone lives on forever in my creator, my country, my fellow man. Words which were never spoken by Donald Trump, but never mind. And so that's wrapped up another edition of Graham Harper's Director's Sound and Director's Vision. That's a wrap. Shall we go out with the Lone Ranger then, Graham?
Yes, please.
The Lone Ranger.
Are you silver?
A fiery horse with the speed of light, a cloud of dust, and a hearty Hi-yo Silver. The Lone Ranger.
Hi-yo Silver! Away!
With his faithful Indian companion Tonto, the daring and resourceful masked rider of the plains, led the fight for law and order in the early West. Return with us now to those thrilling days of yesteryear. The Lone Ranger rides again.